From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. For quite some time, it hasn't exactly been news that Oregon experiences pretty bad fire seasons during the summer, and this year is no different. What is different this year, however, is the amount of uncertainty around the availability of federal resources to help fight those fires. Couple that fact with our historically low amount of snowfall this winter, and the prospect for mega fires hitting the state has many people on edge. Today on the show, we talk with an Oregon Capitol Chronicle reporter about what Governor Kotek and Oregon's federal delegation are saying and worrying about with regard to the upcoming fire season. Then, in the second part of the show, we talk with a reporter at OPB about the historic season opener for Oregon's newest pro team, the WNBA's Portland Fire. The first game set an attendance record, and fan enthusiasm was off the charts. It's May in Oregon. The flowers are blooming, the birds are singing, and fire managers around the state are worrying about what summer will bring in terms of wildfire. Today on the show, we get an update on what the state's leadership is preparing for with regard to fire season after an historically low snowfall winter. A reporter with the Oregon Capitol Chronicle joins me now. Alex Baumhart, senior reporter with the Oregon Capitol Chronicle. Alex, always great to talk to you. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and always appreciate your contributions to the show. So you attended a recent press event with Governor Kotek talking about fire season. What did the governor say?
She said it will be a hotter, longer fire season in summer, but that overall the state was pretty prepared to respond to it. I think the big message beyond it'll be tough and we're ready was, please don't contribute to any more human-caused wildfires, which were the bulk of wildfires last year.
Which is kind of a change,
right? A big emphasis was be smart about starting fires where, when, and why.
Yeah, and I was going to say, it's kind of a change, right? We're more used to naturally caused fires. That was a bit of an outlier that it happened like that.
Yeah, it had been trending downward, and in no small part because the state had invested quite a bit in messaging about smarter debris burning, campfire safety. So the campaigns that I guess had been effective in years past just didn't resonate last year. So some of that was probably a little bit overconfidence. I talked to the Department of Forestry head last year who'd said basically there was enough there's enough wet weather in part that it probably made people feel more confident about burning than they should have been. So if this summer continues to be this dry, I would imagine people feel less confident about burning their trash and debris.
Yeah.
And probably a little smarter about putting out a campfire.
Yeah. Well, and remind folks just how bad our winter, how dry, equaling bad, our winter was this year.
Yeah, I mean, we're tied. This was record heat. We're tied with like 1938 or some year in the 1930s. And then we have about a third of the snowpack that we typically have during the winter. So it is a bad combination. It's been very hot, very dry, and it's not likely to turn around anytime soon.
Okay. Some of us might remember last season certainly was definitely a concerning fire season, but as I understand it, we had less acreage burn last year. Is the governor concerned that, boy, compared to last year, this could be quite historic?
It's a good question. I didn't get that impression from her. I think the big message was the reason those fires didn't get too out of control last year, rather didn't burn more acreage, was because there have been massive investments in the state infrastructure and workforce in response and prevention to wildfire since 2020. So the bulk of those fires last year were put out pretty quickly, and the ones that grew, they had the resources and the relationships to get local fire districts and fire departments on it, to get help from the feds. They had the airplanes and engines and sort of monitoring equipment that they needed to predict where the fire was going to move. So I think in general, you're seeing way more confidence from the governor and from state fire experts and leaders, because we've had about 5 years of pretty record investment in the type of infrastructure you need to respond to wildfires in the West. Okay. And Oregon was probably behind other states like California and Washington before. And no doubt on a local level, we probably are pretty far behind now, but we are way better than we were 5 years ago.
Okay. And that's great. However, we do hope and rely on federal support. Talk a little bit about that, because that may be the big question going into what could be a really bad fire season.
Yeah, I mean, more than half of Oregon's land is owned and managed by the federal government. So there are these partnerships that we have. Obviously, fire does not abide boundaries. A fire that starts on federal land can easily jump to private or state land, and vice versa. So we count on the Forest Service, largely where the federal firefighting force comes from, mm-hmm. to help us out, and also to reimburse the state when the state fights fires on federal land. Our new state forester, Casey Casey, she seems pretty confident that our federal partnerships will be executed flawlessly. She's been assured that the number of wildland firefighters in Oregon this summer will not be less than it was last year or cut. And, you know, nationwide, it's about 5,700 firefighters that the federal agencies rely on, along with like 900 some firefighters from tribal fire departments that they have relationships with. So she seems confident. Okay. I will say, on the other hand, the other day, Oregon's congressional Democrats, Representatives Suzanne Bonamici and Andrea Salinas, and Senators Ron Wyden, Jeff Merkley, seemed less confident that we were in good shape. They had gone to a wildfire briefing at the Northwest Interagency Fire Coordination Center in Portland, mm-hmm. Which works with like nine states with their state agencies, federal agencies, to coordinate firefighting in the West and in the Northwest. They got the impression that while the firefighting force might be there, because there's been so much shaking up in the federal government, incentivized retirements, buyouts, cuts. I mean, Senator Ron Wyden said that, you know, about 1,400 people from the Forest Service that were cut last year were also red card certified, which means they're trained to respond to a fire. So those aren't even like, you know, your frontline firefighting ranks, but those are the people that would go out, let's say, if there's a fire in the Wallawas, to work with the firefighters and coordinate the communications from a van on a mountaintop with people down in the city below. Stuff like that, where we've seen pretty big personnel losses. Cuts to the air quality monitoring office at the EPA, cuts to atmospheric monitoring and other sort of satellite logistics that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and NASA provide. Those are positions that have been lost, cut, scaled back, defunded. And the congressional delegation really raised the alarm that type of like ancillary support, which seems, I mean, I say it's ancillary, but it's kind of critical, sure. not only to stopping fires, but to keeping firefighters safe.
Yeah.
That stuff's been scaled back. And so that's the big concern.
Yeah. We're used to, I think, looking at the state, kind of a bit of a geographic split, and that Eastern Oregon, drier, more potential for wildfire. Did the governor or the other folks that you talked to, is there a concern that there's one, you know, geographic part of the state that is more ripe for wildfire? Or should we basically be looking at the entire state saying, guess what? It could be anywhere.
Yeah, I think on the one hand, there is this desire to make sure that everybody knows that a wildfire risk is high no matter where you are. Mm-hmm. Realistically, it is Eastern Oregon, I think, that is going to be the focus again, not least of which because we know from years of research that most fires, in fact, happen in rangelands. They happen in grasslands. This has been a big deal in Idaho recently. There's been some great reporting by Boise State Public Radio just about how that's literally impacting insurance rates, specifically for people who are in rangelands who might not have expected that they would be at such high fire risk. You know, we tend to think of wildfires as forest fires.
Yeah.
But that just doesn't bear out. Year after year, the bulk of fires in the West happen on rangelands, grasslands. Casey Casey, our new state forester, also made a good point about just how precipitation changes the dynamics given the topography. So obviously in eastern Oregon, you've got low snowpack, low rain. The effects there, their fire season will start earlier. But because there's been so little snowpack in the Cascades, you will see parts of central Oregon and even west of the Cascades probably have some fires that are higher up just because there's not enough snowpack coming down. So you might, in a Mount Hood area, see fires that are sort of starting at the tree line or in areas that you might have thought were sort of insulated from fire because they're close to snow, but there just hasn't been enough of it.
Yeah, yeah. Alex, my last question for you is, the governor talked about this, I believe it's called the Before You Burn app and how important that is. Talk a little bit about what that does and why, as you talked historically, it's becoming more and more important that people are much more aware of what to do in terms of property and good fire maintenance.
Yeah, to my discredit, and maybe to the discredit of the marketing folks at the state agencies, I had not heard of the app until it was brought up the other day at this news conference. So
I'm guilty as well.
Yeah, I'm like, classically, you're like, well, you developed an app, but you didn't tell anybody about it. So it's fabulous. It's in coordination with federal agencies, state agencies, but the net is, you download, you register. If you are going to do a debris burn or you're planning to, you just go on the app and it'll tell you what are your local regulations, what are the rules, are you allowed that day to burn,
Alex Baumhardt, senior reporter at the Oregon Capital Chronicle, friend of the show, always appreciate you coming on and talking about the great articles you write.
Oh, thanks so much, Michael. It's a pleasure, always.
Kyra Buckley of OPB joins me now to paint the scene at Moda Center during the first game of Oregon's brand new WNBA franchise. Kyra Buckley, OPB's business reporter. Kyra, always great to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm kind of jealous because you got to go to the first game of the Portland Fire. Before I even ask you any questions, let's do this. You gave me some sound from the PA announcer and the crowd noise when the team is about to be announced for the first time. Let's play that. And then on the other side, I want to get your reaction to it. So here we go.
And now, making their return to the WNBA, please welcome to the court, your Portland Fire! First, let's meet the reserve.
Wow. I mean, that kind of gave me chills. So you were there. What was the atmosphere like from your perspective?
Yeah, so that was the sound of 19,335 fans.
Wow.
By the way, that's a sold out Moda Center. And that's the most fans ever to show up for an expansion team's home opener. It was pretty amazing. I mean, it was honestly just really emotional to watch the amount of support and it was so loud. I could just feel it through my whole body. And that energy really was there for the entire game, even though, as we'll get into in a second, the Fire did end up losing their first game. But you wouldn't know it based on the crowd. Everybody was just so excited and so engaged. I've been to a lot of pro basketball, women's basketball games, and I truly have never seen anything quite like it.
That is exciting. Yeah. So, of course, nothing was normal about the road that led to this first game. Remind folks, what the Fire had to do even to field the team, and talk about, the incredibly compressed timeline they had to do it in.
Yeah. So normally an expansion team for the WNBA has about 5 to 6 months to put their roster together. And at that same time, they're building up fan excitement and experience. And normally they know who their big player is going to be. Mm-hmm. Well, the Portland fire had about 5 to 6 weeks to do that process. That is actually in part because of a huge win for the WNBA players this season. They were in labor negotiations up until the last minute. There was a little fear that it might infringe on the season, but they did get those labor negotiations wrapped up. And that led to this really transformational collective bargaining agreement where the players are going to get paid more. They're going to get an increasing share of the revenue that they're helping to generate. So that's really exciting for the league overall. But for the Portland Fire, it really gave them just this short crunch time. So they ran their expansion draft about 5 weeks before tip-off. Then they did some trades. They had the rookie draft and they got to training camp. And they've really only had a couple weeks to hang out together before playing their first official game.
Wow. Wow. Well, you saw them play. Talk about the team and maybe give us an idea of what kind of team it is. Is it a run and gun team? Is it a great shooting team? Is it a low post team? Kind of what do you think their personality might become as the season goes along?
Yeah, you know, first of all, it is still a young team. They have a couple of veterans, but then they have a lot of players that are in their first 3 years in the WNBA. That also means they're quite energetic
sure.
and quite fast, and they're very fun to watch. I think that we are going to see an imperfect team that's going to experiment with a lot of different people on the floor and different plays. But, you know, one thing that head coach Alex Sarama has really talked about is they want to be known for their pressure and their intensity, and they want to make it hard for other teams to come play here. Look, they know that they might not win a ton of games this season, but they want to put pressure on defense. They want to be pesky. They want to be in the face of the other players. And they also have all talked about how they're going to feed off the crowd energy for part of that too. So I really think that they're going to just keep developing into a team that's hopefully playing a little bit more cohesively. The first game was a little awkward at times. You could see sure. they were still getting used to each other, which one would expect. But I think we're going to see some, as they keep playing more, I think we're going to continue to see pretty fierce defense, pretty intense basketball, and hopefully some more creative plays.
Yeah. Of course, you know, one of the blueprints is, you know, about 500, 600 miles to the south. The Golden State Valkyries had success right away. But, you know, from who you've talked to and just being there, that's not the same expectation here, is it?
No. I mean, first of all, let's just give a shout out to the Valkyries.
Yeah.
Like, they set the bar so high for an expansion team. And they really put, I mean, they had, as we already mentioned, they had that 5 to 6 month window
sure.
to build their team. They came in with a really strong head coach. They were ready to win and they made the playoffs in their first season. And they did it also with a really strong fan base. Portland, definitely a little different. You hear the team leadership here, the coach, the general manager, they're really talking about creating a culture that is uplifting women athletes. And part of that is they have a whole training process that's pretty novel. I do not understand the wonkiness of it, but it is, the idea is to really have a place where they can study women athletes and hopefully make the game safer, stronger, better. And at the same time, really try some new creative basketball. So again, I think that just means that what we're going to see is some really fun games, but maybe not a lot of wins this season. But I think the team is still going to be pretty positive if they're able to kind of work together and create the culture that they want to create, or at least that's the sense I've gotten in this nascent season so far.
Sure, sure. Let me reintroduce you to the audience, talking with Kyra Buckley. She's OPB's business reporter and very astute and a WNBA fan. So you also, you know, talk to some players, and I want to play a clip about how this team is bonding, and it's from Sarah Ashley Barker. Let's listen to this.
When we got good plays, we were all high-fiving and coming together in our timeouts and huddles and all that. we really were just trying to give each other ideas and listening. And when you can have a team come together and build that chemistry on and off the court, like, it's really special to see what can happen on the floor too. And so as long as we just stay together, we're going to have a really fun season.
Boy, you know, again, hearing her words and thinking this team was kind of rushed together, it kind of sounds like the right mindset, which is, you know, we're really in this together.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I was really struck with just how the players talked about how they, like, basically got on the ground here in Portland. And even though some of them were longtime veterans in the W, more of them, like I said, are in their first few years. But they're all new to Portland and they're all new to this team. And so Sarah Ashley Barker said that that really put them in this unique situation and that she was surprised at how quickly they bonded together. And then they really supported each other on the floor. And that was really, like, as a fan, it was fun to watch them, you know, uplifting each other, even when they were down, even when it was, you were seeing that they were going to lose the game. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that, and again, I just want to give a shout out to Sarah Ashley Barker. She played off the bench and scored 13 points in that game. So she clearly, you know, had something to prove to her teammates. And I think she did that on the floor. And then she talked about how doing it off the court made it possible.
Yeah. You also talked to fans. I'm going to play a clip from a fan just from their perspective about the atmosphere of opening night. Let's take a listen.
We were down on the tunnel where the players were coming in and out, and they were signing, like, little kids' jerseys and basketballs. And it's just, like, to see women, like, come together like this and support each other, it's magical.
Boy, it's pretty obvious that, you know, they're jazzed about this team, right?
Yeah, yeah. I had an opportunity to talk to Shelly Darcy, and she's actually a longtime Portland resident. But the only time she didn't live in Portland was during the first iteration of the Portland Fire back in the early 2000s. So she told me she just felt like she's been waiting for so long to finally have professional women's hoops in her city. And so, you know, feeling that atmosphere, feeling the support for women's sports. Yeah, when I talked to her, she was totally glowing and really excited for the rest of the season.
Kyra Buckley, she covers business for OPB and covers the WNBA like nobody else. Kyra, thank you again for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Tomorrow on the show, former superstar Oregon football player Kayvon Thibodeau joins us not to talk about play on the field, but about how he's traveling the nation educating football players about the pluses and minuses of financial decisions off of it. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.